The following podcast was recorded on Friday, February 4th, 2011. It followed the Dungeons & Dragons Experience Convention, which wrapped up January 30th in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Taking part are Mike Merles, Senior RPG Designer and D&D Lead Designer, Jeremy Crawford, RPG Editor and Developer, and Rodney Thompson, D&D Developer.
Hello out there, and welcome back to the D&D Podcast. This is our first show of 2011, and I am your host once again, Mike Merles, and with me are Jeremy Crawford.
Hello, everyone.
And Roddy Thompson.
Hey.
So this year, we're changing things up a bit. We're going to have a more of a structured podcast with different segments, some of which will be recurring features, and sometimes, depending on the news of the day or what topics we want to cover, we may swap things up. So in this episode, I'll be leading off talking about the D&D Experience Convention that I attended last week. We're going to have Mailbag with Jeremy, and then Rodney is going to debut his sort of corner of the podcast, Good Gaming. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. So last week, I and a few other people from R&D and a whole bunch of gamers went to the D&D Experience Convention, DDXP, held in lovely Fort Wayne, Indiana, in January. So, yeah, it was a little cold, a little snowy. We just missed the monstrous storm.
Just a little snowy?
Actually, it snowed only a little bit the first 2 days. I flew out just before that monstrous storm crushed the Midwest. So luckily, I was able to get home on Monday. But yeah, the show overall was a good time. It's run as usual by the able Dave Crist, the baldmangames.com. That's sort of his website, and he runs our D&D presence at DDXP, at Origins, and at Gen Con. And there's some pretty interesting things going on this year. These the new Ashes of Athas campaign that Dave, I believe, is sort of running with a few volunteers in the community. They had three adventures that debuted. And the kind of interesting thing about this is obviously first it's set in Dark Sun. And it's also an opportunity if you've ever wanted to try an organized play program. It has one large plot line that all the adventures touch on. So the idea is you play from one adventure to the next. And as adventures progress, they will hold off on writing the next wave of adventures until the prior ones have been played. From what I understand, I didn't get a chance to play them, but I was looking up on their website. It looks pretty interesting. I know a lot of people that I talked to the show had a really good time playing through those. So if you're going to be at Origins or Gen Con this year, just check those out. And it kind of shows maybe, you know, just trying to see what's out there as far as organized play. Living Threat Realms was out in force as usual. That's our main organized play program for experienced players. There was the Battle Interactive. If you've never been to a Battle Interactive, I highly recommend it if you have any interest in going to a game convention. It's essentially one huge event. We have dozens, hundreds of people playing at once, all as part of one huge battle at a location. And so this year, the battle was set in Mythdranor. And there were a few adventures that led up to it. And the great thing is you can be almost at any level and take part. I believe it covers some characters levels 1 to 10. So they'll just, if you show up the first level character, they'll find the right table for you and you can have a good time, you know, and go through the adventure that's appropriate for your character's level.
I'm curious, what was the outcome of the battle?
I don't know. The outcome wasn't until late, and so I was usually already had left the convention right. By the time they're done around 1 in the morning.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it sounds like there's a pretty heavy time investment when it comes to these battle interactives.
Yeah, there it's hours and hours. I think it's like 2 or 3 4-hour slots strung together.
No, I was listening to you describe it, and I was just sort of in my mind, I was in story mode, so I'm thinking, well, did Mythdranor fall? What happened?
I think that they assume that it doesn't get destroyed. So this is also the premiere of the Epic campaign. So for 21st level and higher characters, they have the opportunity to keep playing through LFR content. And we also had a few seminars with touching on new releases. We showed off the virtual table. We had a chance for Chris Perkins. He was in the room as the DM with the players back here in Renton, in Washington, playing. So we kind of show off some of the functionality.
Did it work?
Yeah, it did work. It is still in beta, though, so there's still things to, obviously, bugs to quash and interface issues are working through. And I believe everyone at the show who attended that seminar had the chance to sign up for the beta.
Good.
And so that's expanding, and that's still rolling along. And we also talked a bit about new products. I'll just touch on those pretty quickly. Fortune cards were at the show. That's something that a lot of people have been asking us about, and that's definitely a case of, as we look at to see what the reaction of the fortune cards are, how people are using them, what people like and dislike, you know, this is a really new thing we're doing, so we're paying a lot of attention to how it plays out. We also announced a few products that you guys may not have heard of yet. It's Conquest and Wrath is our large-scale board war game, 2 to 4 players, each controlling a kingdom and waging war against the other players. We also announced the Legend of Drizzt board game. That is going to be a game that's a lot like Castle Ravenloft, uses the adventure system. And that, I think, is it. Because actually, I have sitting right next to me our new tabletop games manager.
That's
so,
right.
So, Rodney, do you have anything you want to add about those board games?
Or I think the people that have been playing our Castle Ravenloft game and then looking forward to Wrath of Ashardalon, which I believe is the 15th as the release date for that one, they'll get a lot out of the Legend of Drizzt game because it's going to follow the same format, obviously use the heroes from the Drizzt series of novels, and it's going to be another sort of expansion and also a standalone game. So if you're familiar with Ravenloft and familiar with Wrath of Ashardalon, you'll know what's coming out there. And of course, Conquest of Nerath is actually a pretty interesting story about how the game got made. It's one of those games that was come up with by one of our internal designers. Rich Baker was sort of the head honcho in charge of creating this game, and he actually created it some years ago, and we pulled it out of the archives when we started doing more board games, and it got more development, and so it's a game that has been in the works for, 5-6 years at the very least, and that has now managed to see the light of day thanks to our new focus on board games for part of our schedule as well. So both of those are pretty exciting to me. I think Conquest of Nerath is going to be really cool for people that like more of the war game type experience. If you like games like Axis and Allies or even Risk, Conquest of Nerath is going to be your kind of game. But of course, set in the D&D universe, set in the world of the Nintir Vale, we call it Nerath. And I think this is going to be a good chance for people who like that kind of game and also people who are just sort of fans of the Nintir Vale setting to pick up a little bit more about that setting as well.
We're fans of scads of plastic fantasy miniatures.
Yeah, yep. If you want a whole bunch of little miniatures for wargaming, it's a great product for something like that.
Yeah. So on the role-playing game side, August sees the release of the Neverwinter campaign setting. That one I think I'm actually looking forward to, primarily because of the way that the character options are integrated into the setting. I like the idea. If you've seen the themes from Dark Sun, this book is also going to have themes. And since it focuses on a relatively narrow geographical area, you can kind of sort of think of like Dark Sun sort of has its focus on its area. Neverwinter is even more focused. The themes that are available in that book speak directly to the setting. So if you chose a theme, say, to be a member of a barbarian tribe, there's also story material that says, well, since you're a member of this barbarian tribe, here's what that means for your character. Here are some of the people you know. Here's some of the resources you have. It's really about making your character part of the setting. And so I'm looking forward to see how that plays out and how people react to it. I think it's kind of neat to always have that. It's really kind of an easier way for the DM to have hooks into the adventure. I always like things like that in campaigns where, like, if you have a campaign set in a city and one of the characters is in the Thieves Guild, you can just give that player, if you will, hear a few people you know and important figures, and then you can kind of drop those into the adventure, and it just adds that extra bit of drama or tension, or it's just an option. If the character knows that he can go talk to the guildmaster, that just gives the players another option they can use in the adventure or in the campaign and just deal with the repercussions of that. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think the comparison to Dark Sun is actually particularly apt because the world of Dark Sun is actually geographically quite small. It's not that much bigger than some of the states in the western United States. Of course, Neverwinter zooming in on a city and its surrounding environs is even smaller than that. But it's interesting how I think what's really exciting about this book to me is that it takes this small geographical area and zooms in on it so much that it becomes this sort of vibrant, exciting campaign setting all its own so that you can have adventure after adventure after adventure in a relatively small geographical area. But it still seems like there's a lot of opportunity for, an entire campaign set in this area. I ran the Shackled City campaign in 3rd edition, which was centered around this city called Cauldron. It was in the caldera of a volcano, and everything in the campaign sort of took place in a geographical area around that. I think Neverwinter has the opportunity to create more campaigns like that, where everything sort of touches on this central base location and then fans out from that like spokes on a wheel. So there's definitely some potential for a sort of different kind of campaign setting than we've done before, but at the same time, something that is very classic in the way it works.
And the Neverwinter book has, you mentioned spokes in a wheel. It has throughout the book these plot threads that extend from Neverwinter far across the Forgotten Realms, hooks to Thay and hooks to other areas with different organizations that are in play in Neverwinter, different people vying for power. So it telescopes in, but connects to the whole setting.
We also talked a little bit more about Madness at Gardmore Abbey. That's this year's Super Adventure. It's a box set. And one of the kind of the nifty things about it is it will come with a deck of many things, which as an item, as an artifact, plays a role in the adventure. So we're looking forward to that. And it kind of ties into the sort of how we're looking at role-playing game products as far as components go. You know, giving you a little more value instead of just giving you a book, giving you a more complete experience, you know, as far as getting all the, you know, maybe tiles or tokens for the creatures in an adventure. If you look at how we did Monster Vault, there's the second Monster Vault coming out this year. We announced it prior to this show, but it's the Threats to the Nentir Vale, and that's going to have the same format. It's going to have a box set, monster book, tokens for everything, kind of giving an all-in-one product. And actually, I know Rodney works with the board games, but he was also an RPG designer, and that brings us to November's release, Heroes of the Feywild. Do you want to mention anything about that?
Yeah, actually, I'm really excited about the way the book turned out. I just finished turning that book over to development recently, in fact.
We were talking about it this morning.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it because it follows our new format that's pioneered by Heroes of Shadow, and it's more of a general-purpose book. It's designed to give a lot of different types of characters a connection to a central theme. And, of course, this one is obviously focused on the Feywild, which means that the heroes you're going to make with a book like this are ones tied very much into this sort of magical alternate planes, the magical reflection of the world that is sort of untouched by a lot of the dirtiness of the world at large, right? So you have beautiful Aladrin cities and, you know, strange mystical forests and you know, all these locations out of high fantasy and out of fairy tale, really. And this book answers the question, what do heroes that come from that realm look like? Or what do heroes that are shaped by that realm look like? For example, we talk a lot about the idea that maybe your character isn't from the Feywild, but grew up sort of on the fringes of civilization where there are fey crossings. And so, you know, fairy tales about things coming out of the Feywild and snatching children, those aren't just fairy tales to you. Those are actually things that you have to worry about as a person that lives near a fey crossing. So you have all these superstitions, and, you know, maybe you sprinkle cold iron shavings around your bed at night to keep satyrs from coming in and snatching you out. Well, you know, things like that, talking about not only how that shapes your character's personality and actions, but also giving you the mechanics to reflect that. So I'm really jazzed about how the book came out. You know, working on it was a pleasure. And also, there's a lot of kind of strange fairy tale material in there that I'm really excited to see how people react to that.
Which means I'm looking forward to using it in my campaign, since my campaign is just wall-to-wall fairy magic.
Yes, there's definitely at least one class in there that was basically our designer's love letter to Jeremy Crawford's campaign.
So, speaking of character options and stuff, I'd heard that this is the book with the first dual role character.
That's right. I don't know how much we can say about it, but basically the character is, the class is designed so that you start the encounter with one role, and as the encounter goes on, you may shift to another role entirely. You don't do it at the same time, so it's not like hybriding where you're sort of on a round-by-round basis switching back and forth. This is more like you flip a switch and your role changes. And I think it's going to be really exciting because, A, that's sort of a gameplay method we haven't really seen yet in 4th edition. But at the same time, I think it's going to also help the flow of an encounter, because when you make that change to your other role, it's going to hasten the end of the encounter, but also sort of up the tension of the late parts of the encounter. So, you know, it's an opportunity for us to do something new for players, and also to sort of tinker with the encounter dynamic, which I think is really fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's something that kind of segues into our next topic. If you've been following the news, we've had a number 3 print products that we pulled off the schedule. DDXP, that question came up a few times from people, and I kind of wanted to reiterate what I said at the convention and just kind of, you know, give you more of the reasoning and thinking behind what's going on. So basically what we're doing, like Rodney was just talking about, this new character class is going in a really different direction, and it's really offering something new and hopefully exciting to you guys. And that sort of ties into why you're seeing us pull back some things, and why, if you look at our schedule, we're not doing as many books this year as we've done in past years. And really that comes down to, the big reason is it's our commitment to quality. We, in the past year, have noticed how many rules updates we've had to issue. We've seen the complaints from people on message boards at conventions, and we really want to make sure that if we're putting something out there, it's the highest quality we can attain. And in some ways, the more product you do, the harder it is to do that, to deliver on that. The magazines, the workflow there has changed. We're now treating them just like our other products. We'd always worked on them. They're always official. But I think the method we had built for them wasn't doing the material justice. So we're changing how we do that. We're going to spend more time on what we're doing. We're going to do more planning, more long-term planning of it. And that segues into what Roddy was just talking about. When we have more time, and we take more time on things, we can be more daring, we can push the envelope, we can be more certain through playtesting, just through more research and just not writing everything that we're working on and thinking of it as it has to be published to justify the time we're working on it. It lets us be more creative, it lets us be more daring, and it lets us find the push the frontier outward of the game. So it's something I'm really excited about as group manager. And it's something that I think in the long run, it may seem a little worrisome while you're pulling back releases. I know everyone online wants to give their opinion. And, you know, really the thinking is, and the reasoning behind it is, commitment to quality. And from that, part of quality is innovation. So really, that's what that comes down to. Now, I know a lot of people were looking forward to the material in those products. It was Mordenkainen's Magnificent Emporium. There was the Class Compendium, which had the sort of mechanics that let you mix essential style characters with our traditional 4th edition style characters, and also the Hero Builder's Guidebook, which had already cannibalized the Heroic Tier book. So there's some shuffling going on. A lot of that material was stuff that was sort of cutting edge. It's sort of new approaches to characters, and we want to make sure it works, and we want to make sure we get it right. But we're also listening, I know with Mordenkainen's, people have been talking about the rarity system for magic items. That's something where when we look at the magazines to give you some more rare items, we're definitely thinking about the issue of how do we categorize all the items we published prior to that system. I mean, right now they're defaulting to be uncommon, with some picked out as common, but we're definitely, at least I'm thinking of how can we better address this more precisely. And that all comes back down to if we're not just thinking we have to write X thousands of words each day and get out a book a month, and it gives us a little more time, it gives us a little more breathing room, and it, I think, at the end of the day, makes for a better game.
Yeah, if you look at the way we sort of put out products for the first couple of years, I mean, the first, we're good 2.5 years into 4th edition at this point. Like, the first 2 years, we were sort of trying to cover the basics of the game, right? I mean, Player's Handbook 1 and 2 covered all the classic classes. By the time Player's Handbook 3 comes out, you've introduced Psionics, which is a long and storied tradition in D&D. And now it's time for us to start pushing the envelope. And you saw that start a little bit with Dark Sun. I mean, I know the process on Dark Sun was actually very different from the process on a lot of other books. I mean, I was the lead developer on that book, and I got involved very early in the process, right? I mean, as a developer, I was in the very first meeting we held about Dark Sun and took that book all the way from conception to printing, and so did Rich, who was the lead designer. Like, the two of us basically worked all the way through the process together to usher the book through, and it was a really great process, but it was also a lot more time consuming, right? He and I spent a lot more time on that book than I would say any other book I'd worked on up to that point. So when you have this process that works really well, but it's time consuming, you know, you really got to look at your schedule and say, what's better, to get the books out in, you know, a hurry, or to spend a little bit more time on them. And I think that now that we have sort of covered the basics of 4th edition and covered the basics of D&D, and we are looking to do new and strange things, it's better for us to take our time and, you know, thoroughly explore everything and then give our designers and developers time to usher these things through the whole process rather than try and rush them out. So I'm actually really excited because, you know, I'm looking at the process and it looks a lot more like the Dark Sun process. I mean, I know that on Heroes of the Feywild, for example, we all sat down and concepted that book out early. You know, I walked that book all the way through design, did a lot of design myself, but also we had some really talented freelancers working on it. And then now, as it passes into development, I'm actually going to continue to work with Jeremy and Steve Schubert, our other developer, to make sure it gets, you know, the kind of development it needs. And then, of course, the playtesting it needs and walk through editing as well. And it's a little bit more time-consuming process, but I think in the end, it produces something that people are more excited about. I mean, Dark Sun showed that. The response to Dark Sun was excellent. And Dark Sun's a good example of where we also pushed the envelope a little bit. I mean, we introduced themes there that are now being integrated into the larger game through, you know, Neverwinter, for example, right? So, you know, we get this sort of cutting-edge game tech that comes out of it that's also really good for telling the story of Dark Sun. And I think that's, you know, a great example of the kind of quality that we're going to be aiming for with the new process.
So I think I would say the whole department is excited about this approach. And being able to lavish as much love as we can on everything that we're doing.
Yeah, especially since we want to try sort of new and wacky things. When you get into game mechanics that are really different from what we've done up to that point, you're really in new territories. There's an exploration phase there where you're like, what does this even mean? What does this do for the game that you don't necessarily have when you're doing something like, you know, okay, I want to do a new build for the fighter. Well, the fighter is sort of a known quantity at that point, right? So you're not doing as much exploration. Well, when it comes to something new, you really have to explore the concept fully. I mean, you end up going down a lot of dead-end trails, right? You end up getting to the point where you're like, okay, this isn't working. Let's take two steps back and, you know, take this other fork in the road. And that's just not a process that you necessarily have when you're working with known quantity mechanics.
Yeah. So that about covers the DDXP convention. Thanks a lot to Dave Crist for putting on the show, and thanks to everyone who DM'd a slot for all the hundreds of players who showed up. Really great debut for the new Ashes of Athas campaign. It's really exciting stuff. And I'm looking forward to seeing where it leads at Gen Con.
For those of you attending PAX East, taking place March 11th through the 13th in Boston, we look forward to seeing you there. Wizards of the Coast will be on hand playing D&D Encounters, showcasing builds from Heroes of Shadow, and presenting a session of the Dungeons & Dragons virtual table.
Now it's time for Mailbag, the segment where we attempt to answer your questions about D&D rules, DMing Dungeons & Dragons, or any Dungeons & Dragons questions that you care to send in to us. And I will repeat what we say every podcast right up here up front. Please do send your questions in to dndinsider@wizards.com. And the N in the address is the letter N, not an ampersand. So we'll jump right into the questions. And the first one relates to what Mike was just talking about. He mentioned the Conquest of Nerath board game. And this is a question also about military campaigns in Nerath, but specifically in the context of a D&D campaign. Here's the question. This is from Ian. I'm hoping to start a campaign sometime soon with a military theme, in which the characters first defend the Nentir Vale from an invading hobgoblin army, and then go on to establish a new empire via conquest and diplomacy, perhaps even liberating Nerath's capital city from the Gnolls. My problem is how to run a large-scale military engagement in a way that's both exciting and reasonably fast. I like the victory point method used in the adventure from the DM's kit, but none of the encounters really feel like the characters are participants in a pitched battle. Do you have any suggestions for running large military engagements?
I actually tackled this subject a little bit in the Star Wars role-playing game because, you know, Star Wars has even got war in the title there, right? There's obviously a lot of big engagements. But what I like to do when I run adventures like this in any system is I actually sort of think of the battlefield like a dungeon, right? And I think about the different areas of the battlefield as rooms in the dungeon. So, for example, when you charge up to the front lines of battle, that's like going into the room full of orcs in the dungeon. Sure, you know, there's more scenery and less boundaries around you, but it's effectively a small location that can be part of a larger, you know, a larger area, right? And then I just sort of segment off different areas of the engagement, like the front lines. That's the, you know, running into the room full of orcs, or over here where you come up against the siege engines. That's a lot like running into a trap room, right? So maybe you know instead of disarming the trap, you're actually sabotaging the enemy's siege engines, right? Or you know, okay, there's a big ogre on the battlefield or whatever. Maybe that's one of those types of encounters where you're having to sort of lead the ogre through the gauntlet of your allies, right? Just, you know, think of it like these different encounter areas are rooms in a dungeon, but each room has sort of its own shtick, its own feel, and there's something to, you know, explore, something to interact with, and then also, you know, likely, since it's a big pitched battle, something to fight. But not every fight has to be a straight up, okay, there's the five of us heroes, and there's these five orcs, so we have to fight them head to head. That's more like what you want to do for the front lines. Like I said, you know, the example of the siege engines is a great example of, that's, you know, probably a combat encounter, but it's probably one where your goal is actually using, you know, thievery or whatever to disable these these siege engines, right? It's more like interacting with a trap. And then you might say, okay, this other, you know, part of the battle where we're trying to sneak behind enemy lines, that's more like the encounter where stealth and subterfuge are more important than, you know, the straight-up fight. So you give your players different goals for different areas of the battlefield and let them figure out how to tackle those goals on their own. And you're actually kind of, you know, you benefit from the lack of physical boundaries on the battlefield in that it gives players a little bit more freedom to come up with their own strategy and tactics. So, for example, instead of charging into the front lines, they might decide to sneak around and infiltrate the enemy's, you know, command area, right? Once they're done taking down the commanders, then they approach the front lines from, you know, their own side, and that battle suddenly changes from, okay, I'm running head-to-head against orcs, to, okay, we're ambushing these orcs, or something like that. So, you know, thinking of the battlefield like a big dungeon is one way to do the big battlefield encounter.
And it's amazing how the dungeon analogy can be used for so many different kinds of scenarios, not just war, as you mentioned, because I think it works great for war, but in city adventures, in a lot of wilderness adventures, often you can just translate different settings, different events into essentially dungeon rooms and have people make their choice. You know, are they going to go to, as you say, Rodney, the front lines, or head, you know, try to do a flanking maneuver? It's very similar to, you know, they're in the cultist monastery. Are they going into the scriptorium first, or are they going into the high chapel? It often ends up playing out very similarly. I think I've also in the podcast talked about before running large skirmishes where you can, as a DM, give the players NPCs to control in addition to their characters. But not full-fledged NPCs in the sense that, you know, these are not characters who have all the details that a player character would have, but they're more like monsters, and let them control the forces who are on their side, and then the DM can control a larger-than-normal force of monsters, larger than you would normally put in a D&D encounter.
Yeah, especially when you talk about things like the companion character rules from, I think it was DMG 2.
Yes.
Or even just minions, right? I mean, there's a great advantage in 4th edition that you can take the minion rules and apply that both to allies and enemies and say, okay, here are your five minions. You get to you're leading this squad, right? And, you know, yeah, you move them around, and when they get killed, they get killed, right? But if the DM is also using minions as well, you can sort of get this pitched battle feeling by having a wave of minions on one side, a wave of minions on the other side, and when they hit, you know, they start dropping like flies, and it doesn't take as long as, you know, a full-fledged group of, you know, full monsters would, but it still gives you that same kind of feel.
One way I dealt with the potential problem of a large battle taking too much time at the game table, the last time I did this in my campaign, is for certain groups of forces, like there would be a group of archers positioned on top of a tower. Rather than making attack rolls for every single one of those archers, I would make a single attack roll for the entire group. They would have sort of an aggregate damage value that they could all deal if there was a hit. And then the player characters had the option of, as a standard action on their turn, rather than attacking themselves, of taking various command actions to give their forces bonuses of different sorts. A bonus to that group attack roll, you know, to yell out some defensive maneuver, which would give a bonus to defenses for all of their minion troops. It ended up working out really well. And I know in my campaign, the character, appropriately enough, who was typically giving these orders was the bard. And so, you know, the bard was singing out, inspiring the troops. And it really created a nice narrative at the table and, thank goodness, prevented it from turning into just a complete slog. Our next question is a perennial D&D question. This is a question from Grant. What happens if a player character turns a bag of holding inside out, or puts a bag of holding inside another bag of holding, or turns two inside out and puts one inside the other, etc., etc., etc.?
Well, I guess this probably, I'm sure the rule right now is nothing special happens, but that's fairly boring. So I always liked the entire, you rip a hole in the universe and get sucked through it and end up somewhere strange. I always liked the idea of the bag of holding was like some gateway, like when you threw stuff in it, it was actually getting stuck in some like weird pocket universe and maybe someone could come along and steal your stuff.
Yeah, I actually ran a second edition adventure where the guys, they put all their stuff in the bag of holding, and then later they were cruising around on the astral plane for some reason, I can't remember why, and they see this pile of stuff there, and they're like, that looks a lot like our stuff, right? And yeah, it was.
Or it could be, yeah, it could all be showing up in some hag's house.
Yeah.
She made all these bags of holding to fool people into dumping all of their treasure into her cottage.
Well, see, this isn't really addressing the question, though. I think the there's actually only one real answer to this, and that's thermonuclear explosion.
Right? Campaign world destroyed.
Right, right. Or summon the Tarrasque, one of the two.
I think that as far as turning inside out, I think when you reach inside, you can't really even feel the size.
Yeah, there's nothing to grab.
There's nothing to grab. And I also think it'd be kind of cool. I mean, this is where I like to be weird as a DM. Like, as you're sticking your hand down there, maybe sometimes you feel something moving around in there, or someone else's hand touches yours for a moment.
And you get like an astral plane high five or something.
Yeah, inadvertent high five. But I think if you put a bag inside the other bag, I think both the one you put it inside of ruptures. The other one is cast into the astral and lost, like old school here. I think that's how it was in first edition, and you have to go find it.
Right.
And maybe you have a giant portal that stuff starts coming out of.
I think the bottom line is this falls firmly in the realm of DM's choice.
Yeah.
It really comes down to how gonzo does the DM want the magic to be in his or her campaign.
Yeah.
You know, if the DM doesn't want to be bothered with black holes or the Tarrasque showing up or a hag collecting all of the group's gear, you can just say, well, nothing happens. But it could also be a great opportunity for a twist in an adventure.
Or
annihilation.
Well, other than campaign annihilation, it might be a great chance for a campaign shift. So, for example, if your player is bound to determine to turn that bag of holding inside out, maybe when he does, there is a sudden outburst of mist, and then you find yourselves walking through the mists of Ravenloft or something. I mean, we've all used that mm-hmm. you get transported to another plane, you know, type scenario before, but a lot of times the players will do these kind of wacky things just to see what happens, and having something in your back pocket that happens that completely alters the campaign can sometimes be kind of fun, even if it's just for a few sessions, right? Like, oh, okay, we turned the bag of holding inside out, and now we're in Ravenloft for 3 sessions, have to find our way out, and, you know, that's the whole month's worth of adventure. That's fun, right? And that's something that you'll tell your gaming group buddies about for years to come.
We have more questions to answer, but no more time for mailbag. So please continue to send your questions in, and we will get to as many of them as we can in future podcasts. And remember, the address is dndinsider@wizards.com.
Now it's time for our newest segment, Good Gaming. Each podcast, we discuss what we are enjoying in the world of gaming, ranging from games that we like to what's inspiring us in the games we run or play in. Gaming is good, but good gaming is better. And to start us off, I actually want to talk about the next season of D&D Encounters because, I wrote it. And so I figure I might as well start this new segment off with a topic that I'm somewhat of an expert on so that we can keep the ball rolling. As a lot of people may already know, the next season of D&D Encounters is March of the Phantom Brigade, which is both an allusion in title to a group of monsters appearing in the next Monster Vault, but also the adventure touches on a classic adventure that I'm sure that you guys have probably played, the Ghost Tower of Inverness.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, while you don't actually go inside the Ghost Tower, let's put it this way, Castle Inverness makes an appearance, and I think that people who are big Greyhawk fans will find a lot to like about the appearance of the Ghost Tower in this adventure. But I wanted to talk about a little bit about the process of building it, because it was actually a really educational experience for me. One of the things that I learned very quickly is that writing a D&D encounter season is nothing like writing a normal adventure, because you not only have to sort of guide people through a week-by-week expansion of the story, and it's a little more linear, but also you can't rely on your players to have done the same things, but at the same table. So you might have 2 people that killed one NPC, 2 people that let him live, and 2 people that didn't even encounter him in the first place. So there are a lot of sort of strange challenges that arose from building this encounter season that I feel like, you know, now I'm a little bit more prepared to write a very different style of adventure. I also tried to focus a lot on the exploration and role-playing side of things? Because I know, and you guys have probably heard this as well, but I know that we've gotten a lot of people saying D&D Encounters is a lot of fun, but I wish it felt a little bit more like a home game, right? So, you know, one of the things I was really looking forward to doing was seeing if I could take the time constraints of a, you know, an hour, hour and a half D&D encounter session and fit in the sort of expected combat encounter along with some sort of exploration and role-playing and interacting with NPCs and a little bit more rich stories. So I've just recently, we've gotten our copies here in the office and been flipping through it, and it was great to see the sort of several months of exploration and figuring out how to do these D&D encounter seasons come to fruition. And so that's what's making me happy in gaming these days. What about you guys?
Well, as you were talking, I was just sitting here reminiscing about being a kid and running a tournament in a friend's house of the Ghost Tower of Inverness module, because it was originally a tournament module at an early Gen Con, I think.
Mm-hmm. Origins, actually.
Oh, was it Origins? Yeah. Okay. And so I ran a group in one room of my friend's house, and he ran a group in another, and we followed the tournament rules that came with the adventure to find out which group of PCs won. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, so essentially, we had a little mini game convention, all centered on the Ghost Tower of Inverness.
So which group won?
Oh man, I think my group won.
No, it had to have been the
other
group.
But it might be a biased memory.
It had to be the other group, because if your group had won, you would have been immediately like, no, my group won. that memory would have stood out.
So I actually ran that adventure at a game convention in 1992, Total Confusion in New England. Crazy Igor, which is a store that was in northern New York, had it for. They had a bunch of old D&D modules for sale. I happened to buy that adventure at the show, and I think we just had a free 4 or 5 hours. You know, we were going to play D&D, but the events were full or whatever, so I ended up running it for my friends right there, just running it cold, reading ahead while they figured out their characters' equipment. And yeah, it was a fun adventure.
Yeah, I had to do a little bit of research on the Ghost Tower of Inverness, because while I'd read the module before, it had been a really long time, and I've never actually run the module, but I had read it, and so I went back and started reading through it, and man, it reminded me how far we've come, you know, in adventure design from first edition, but then how also many of the tropes that we think of in D&D, how many of those were set down in those early mm-hmm. modules, right? I mean, it seems obvious to say that early D&D obviously influenced the entire D&D, you know, culture and things that we think about as what is a D&D adventure. But Ghost Tower of Inverness is one of those that, you know, it's a little tough to read, and it's, you know, kind of hard to digest what is where. So, you know, we've come a long way in formatting, but man, there's everything in that adventure, right? There's disappearing and appearing towers. There's time travel, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of time travel in that adventure. You know, crazy wizards, powerful artifacts. It's one of those classic adventures that as soon as I started flipping through it, I was like, boy, I'm glad I'm not running this right now, right out of this, but there's a lot to love in this old adventure.
Yeah. I just finished the Dragon Age Origins expansion. I'm getting ready for Dragon Age 2, which I think comes out next month. And it's certainly related to our work in that it's a D&D-inspired series of games. And yeah, I had a good time with it. I'm looking forward to Dragon Age 2.
Yeah, BioWare does great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I still have fond memories of Baldur's Gate.
For me, it was always Knights of the Old Republic, but shocking. That.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Star Wars.
That's right.
So I played an old TSR board game called Divine Right at DDXP, yeah. And it was a lot of fun. It's a kind of conquer the world kind of game. Each player has a kingdom and your armies, and then there's a number of NPC kingdoms that get personalities randomly assigned to them that sort of determines how they act when you try to establish an alliance with them. So it's a fun game. It's a very it's a game with a lot of swing, and it's very random. The combat system is fairly brutal. Armies get destroyed fairly quickly. But it was a lot of fun watching how the different NPC monarchs changed and how alliances would rise and fall apart and the twisting winds of war. It was a really fun time. So I like that kind of big scale game. You see a story emerge as you're playing, as things change. It's like, well, you know, an NPC monarch might die and he's a real coward and his replacement turns out to be this very brave, resolute ally. So another player steps in and assassinates him when you've got an alliance with him. So a new monarch takes over. And it's just fun how things twist and change. So
yeah, there's something really interesting about the stories that come out of board games like that. I know we've talked about it before, but I really like the game Small World. It's a Days of Wonder game. And Small World is this game where these empires of creatures, fantasy creatures, rise and fall. And part of what makes the game, you know, exciting and compelling is that you will go through two or three civilizations on your own every time you play. So, you know, you may see a dozen or so civilizations rise and fall over the course of a game. But what's neat is that it creates these stories that as, oh, the militant elves sweep across the continent, behind them comes a wave of kobolds that are sort of ravaging in their wake. But then, you know, they reach a point where they get smashed by the orc empire as well.
And then watch out, here come the mermen with their starfish nipple pasties.
Well, yes. I think the game's great, though, because by the end of it, you've created sort of the story of this campaign world. And in fact, some of the guys in my gaming group have talked about the idea that we might play a game of Small World to figure out the history of our world up to the present time. And basically, at that point, we would start a D&D campaign with the idea of, okay, we saw the elves rise and fall, mm-hmm. so maybe elves are really rare in the world. Or, you know, okay, the mermen, conquered the continent, so maybe they're, you know, in retaliation, the dwarves sunk their continent or something like that, right? This idea that you sort of create a campaign setting out of a board game like that. It could be a really neat idea. It sounds like an awful lot of work once you play the game for me to come up with the entire campaign setting, so we'll see if that actually happens or not.
Yeah.
Well, that's been our good gaming segment for this podcast. We'll try and do that each time and talk about something that's exciting us in the world of gaming. So thanks for listening.
Join us for the new season of D&D Encounters, March of the Phantom Brigade. With an adventure written by Rodney Thompson, D&D Encounters takes place every Wednesday at a local gaming store near you. To find a participating location, go to the store locator on the D&D website.
So before we wrap up this podcast, we are 2 days away from the Super Bowl. Now, Jeremy, do you know who's playing in the Super Bowl?
I think one of the teams is the Packers.
Okay, and who do you think the other one is?
I have no idea.
It is Packers-Steelers.
All right.
Who do you think will win before you watch Glee?
I'll say the Packers.
Okay.
Simply because there's a fan of the Packers on an NPR podcast that I listen to a lot.
Fair enough.
So I keep hearing about the Packers.
All right, so Rodney, what's your prediction?
I'm going to actually predict the Steelers. I have watched the Steelers all season. My girlfriend is from Pennsylvania, so of course her family, they're all big Steelers fans. I am not. I am unfortunately an Atlanta Falcons and Tennessee Titans fan, so hasn't been the greatest season for me. And after watching Green Bay just shell the Falcons in the playoffs a couple of weeks ago, I just can't bring myself to cheer for them. So I'm going to predict the Steelers win, but I'm going to predict it's going to be a close one. I think that Green Bay has a powerful offense. Steelers have a powerful defense, but I think defense wins championships.
So this is what I think is going to happen. The Green Bay Packers and the Pittsburgh Steelers will take to the field. In the first half, the Steelers run rampant. It's 24-0 at halftime. Fans are all down in Green Bay. They're real depressed. They think their team's going to lose. When suddenly, the second half, the Green Bay Packers play with a renewed sense of purpose and talent levels unseen from this team this year. And they roar back and win 48-24. And as they go out to hand the trophy to Aaron Rodgers, he pulls off his mask to reveal Tom Brady and the New England Patriots playing in the Super Bowl. That is my prediction. The Patriots will win the Super Bowl. That's how they will win it.
Wow.
No, but I think the Packers will win it. I think the Packers, they were actually my pick. No, they were not my original. No, I picked Kansas City and Green Bay. I don't think I gave a winner. But I'm going to stick to my guns. I'm going to say Green Bay is going to win it. Though back on Twitter months ago, I picked Pittsburgh to come out of the AFC.
All right. So thankfully on our D&D podcast, we have spent a good 5-10 minutes on the Super Bowl.
That's what's important.
That's right.
Thanks again for listening. This is the last week of football until the fall. So this is the last time we'll talk about it. Maybe we'll start talking about hockey Or basketball next time.
I can't wait.
Maybe next time we'll talk about Blood Bowl.
We can talk about Blood Bowl, yeah.
That I can talk about.
That you can talk about. So thanks again for listening. Don't be afraid to drop us a line at dndinsider@wizards.com. Let us know what you think of the new format. And as we go forward, we may tweak a little bit. We may add segments, kind of shift things up depending on what we want to talk about. And we'll keep the podcast coming as long as you guys keep listening. Thanks a lot.